This is David Green. I am the co-founder of Fearless Media, and I am your host here on Left, Right, and Center. This is the show where we take on all the political issues, even the complicated ones that might be dividing your own family these days. Well, this week, the United Nations General Assembly met in New York. They were in person for the first time since the pandemic began. U.S. and European officials slammed Russia's President Vladimir Putin, who is making some even more frightening moves in the war against Ukraine. He's called up 300,000 reservists to join the fight. He also said his threat to use nuclear weapons is not a bluff. At the UN, President Biden said Russia is violating the core tenets of membership in the United Nations. He said this war is all about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state, but we also know there's even more at stake than that. Well, let's bring in our left, right, and center panel here. I'm your host and your center. On the left, we're joined by Jill Filipovich, a journalist and lawyer who covers politics and human rights as a CNN columnist and also writes at jill.substack.com. On the right, we have Ovik Roy. He's president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity and policy editor at Forbes. And I'm also bringing in our special guest who you've heard from before on the show. It's Dr. Evelyn Farkas. She is the executive director at the McCain Institute and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, which makes her the perfect guest to be talking about what we are talking about here today. Welcome, everybody.
Hi, David.
Hey, David.
Thank you.
Well, Evelyn, your expertise makes you the perfect person to hear from in this moment. How seriously should we be taking Vladimir Putin's nuclear threat?
Well, obviously, you never want to dismiss a nuclear threat, David, and thank you for having me on again. In this case, however, I don't think people should be, you know, heading for the nuclear bunkers if they can still find them. The reason is because, look, yes, he has nuclear weapons, and yes, his military doctrine allows him to use them if he feels the existence of the state is threatened, and he's trying to set it up such that if the Ukrainians attack these territories that he's likely to annex, that they will then be attacking the Russian territory if they continue the war. And he's really directing these threats at the West. He's trying to test our resolve. He's trying to scare and intimidate us. It's his version of deterrence because he doesn't have much else. Vladimir Putin, he is not likely to start, to escalate that far because he recognizes even if he just detonates a nuclear weapon as a warning, even if it's in Siberia, it will be a game changer. And President Biden, thankfully, has said as much publicly when he was interviewed on 60 Minutes last Sunday. He said that the international community will not countenance a nuclear weapon being detonated. And in this case, it would be an anger, but anger or no anger being detonated. And the government that does such a thing, I think the international community would very quickly find a way to essentially deem that government illegitimate, and then there would be steps that would be taken, which Biden will not outline, but I will tell you will include use of conventional military force and whatever else it takes to remove Putin from power.
You said so much in so little time. Very impressive. And I want to kind of pause on a couple things, but before we move on, I mean, one, Evelyn, this annexation you mentioned, this is Russia holding these sham referendums in four regions of Ukraine to try and make it seem like people want the Russians to come and take over. And that could give Putin a window to say, I need to use nuclear weapons because this is now Russian territory. So he's changed the message some there. And he also seems to be focusing, as you said, his messaging on the West writ broadly, not just Ukraine, which was kind of freaking me out. But you are giving a message of calm, which I appreciate. But there are reasons to think that he's trying to escalate, no?
He's trying to escalate politically and rhetorically. He's trying to put the pressure on the transatlantic alliance, first and foremost, although we do have Asian countries and other countries around the world who are in the coalition with us, mainly on sanctions, et cetera. But he's trying to test our resolve. He's trying to weaken our resolve. He's trying to probably get us to accept some kind of compromise on the ground, whereby he could hold on to the Donbass area. Frankly, I don't know whether that would be enough for his nationalists anyway, but he's trying to test the waters here, and he's trying to buy time with his call-up, we can talk about that later, of the reserves. But he wants the West to stop supplying the weapons to Ukraine that are so effective. And what we need to do is keep doing it and, in fact, pick up the pace so that the Ukrainians can hit the Russians while they're vulnerable and eliminate the immediate military threat that Russia poses, not just to Ukraine, but frankly, the day after Ukraine, to Georgia, Moldova, and I believe NATO. He would threaten NATO as well.
Why should we be convinced that the United States and NATO are resolved here, given the position of NATO in recent years and a lot of, I don't know, signs of weakness, given that we have President Biden, who's not a very popular president at this moment and has struggled to sort of articulate a clear message in terms of the end game in this war? I mean, what you say that the United States would be ready if Putin did anything nuclear to attack targets in Russia? I mean, am I hearing that right? And you're certain of that?
Yes. And it would start probably with a conventional attack on those facilities that had something to do with directing such a nuclear, you know, again, detonation or attack, depending on how they use the weapon. They would certainly, again, use all the outrage around the world to pressure the Russian government, essentially to push Vladimir Putin out of power if it's not possible by, you know, non-military means. Other means, I guess, would be contemplated. You know, I do know, though, that that our government would no longer balk at using our military to punish Russia. It doesn't mean we would put boots on the ground, but we certainly have access to missiles that can go through from ships and from aircraft at targets. So there would be a price that Putin would pay for sure.
Wouldn't we all pay a price, though? I mean, that's not going to end well if we're firing missiles into Russia.
Of course not. This is why I don't believe that Vladimir Putin is going to try to escalate to the nuclear level, because it's something that he also cannot control very easily and will not end well for him. So my belief is that he's really trying to test our resolve. Getting back to your earlier question, you know, there are, of course, strains within the European Union. We see, you know, Viktor Orban saying, I'm going to hold a referendum and ask my people whether they want to stick with these EU energy sanctions, you know, and he's going to phrase it in such a fashion that they're going to say, no, we don't. We don't want higher energy prices. There is always a weak link. And right now, Hungary is the weakest link because Viktor Orban is so close to Putin and reliant on Putin. You know, the reality is, though, that Viktor Orban can see that Russia's losing as well, and he's flailing. This is, you know, kind of an act almost of desperation, because he realizes these sanctions will hurt his public and that will hurt his popularity. The Turkish government also is another one that is not always a government that we can rely on to, you know, hold firm to the united position that we have with other allies. But what we're seeing, and I think it's very significant, is the German government, led by a social democratic party, which, you know, their former leaders basically have been in, you know, cozying up and in cahoots, if you will, with the Kremlin for years now. So to see the Social Democrats, to say nothing, of course, of the Greens, who have been firmly opposed to Vladimir Putin's aggressive foreign policy, standing on the international stage and saying they will tough it out this winter. I do think, of course, as time goes on, there's always a danger that the coalition will not hold, but I believe that it will. And the more outrageous Putin is, the more of a gift it is to President Biden, who's trying to hold it all together.
Ovik Roy, is President Biden rising to this moment?
I think he is, by and large. I mean, I would say that he's been overly cautious, in particular delivering long-range artillery to Ukraine, because if he had done so earlier, the war would, it unnecessarily prolonged the war and prolonged the conflict, and we're seeing obviously the effects and benefits of that artillery to Ukraine right now. So I think in that way he's been overly cautious, but overall, his policy is not actually controversial, even among most Republicans. Yes, there's a fringe of Republicans who want to become isolationists and whatnot. But broadly speaking, there's a lot of agreement that he's been careful, he's been responsible, he's gone out of his way not to provoke the Russians, though I totally agree with Evelyn. My sources indicate that Biden and his aides have been very direct with Putin and his associates about what would happen in the context of a nuclear attack. And the other thing I would mention, David, as a point of evidence, and look, you've spent a lot of time in Ukraine. I hope you're not shy about sharing your assessment.
Never.
But remember when Finland and Sweden first started making noises about joining NATO, And Putin said, you know, we will basically do all sorts of aggressive things against Finland, belligerent things against Finland and Sweden if they do that. And then the moment that the parliaments or the prime ministers, or I can't remember who it was, said, yeah, we are going to join NATO, he completely flipped. He did a 180. He said, oh, it's totally fine. We don't really care. It's great that Finland and Sweden are joining NATO, right? So he certainly has a track record of being bellicose as a way of trying to achieve the solution he wants and then backing down. And you can never minimize or eliminate or dismiss the risk of a nuclear escalation. But I think both President Biden and the people in the administration have been doing all the right things to assess accurately how Putin is behaving and try to be responsible. The one thing I'd just add, I think it's time to start considering kicking Russia off the UN Security Council. There is a legal argument to be made that the handover of the USSR's permanent seat on the Security Council was not appropriately given to Russia, and the Security Council could vote to take that away, is my understanding. And I'd love to see a serious exploration of that, because Russia is so clearly and egregiously violating the UN Charter.
But couldn't China just veto any move to do that? I mean, isn't that kind of a... not going to go anywhere?
They could if they wanted to, but maybe there's a way to make it worth China's while. I mean, at least at the very least, it's something that we should explore and make some noise about, because I just don't see how the UN can advance its mission when you have a country basically ripping up the UN Charter every day.
Jill, I came into this conversation freaked out by what Putin is saying. Are you freaked out, or are you calm like some of our other guests on the panel here?
I'm a little more freaked out than the other guests on the panel. I mean, it seems to me that Putin is badly backed into a corner, and I am less trustworthy than the other guests that in that position of anger and of, frankly, weakness, that he's going to behave in a rational way. That said, I am calmed somewhat by the fact that at least in the U.S., we have an adult in the White House. This is certainly a moment for me of reflection and gratitude that the last presidential election went the way that it went, and that we're not in this situation with Putin in this moment with a Donald Trump presidency.
Evelyn, can I come back to you? And Ovik, I appreciate you welcoming my own experience in these places. Like, I actually want to look back to 2014 and Crimea and the referendum that was held there. I mean, there was 123% turnout in some parts of Crimea, which tells you how fair that referendum was. I mean, these are sham elections. But I just think about the United States in this moment and whether our recent experience with democracy has undermined our ability to police elections around the world and to validate them. And I feel like even if these things are a sham, that the idea that, you know, people are voting and people in Ukraine, if this is the story that is told, want to be part of Russia, even if, you know, these are total shams, like what can the United States say when we had a president saying that elections aren't fair in our own country? I mean, can't Putin just basically say like, hey, you know, this was good enough. These territories are now Russian. I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, I mean, look, David, he did that, as you said, with Crimea. He could do it again. He's done it in other places. They at one point annexed, they've done like several things in the Republic of Georgia, you know, where first they said that 20% the territory that the Russians occupy should be independent, and then they said they annexed them. So I will agree with you, though, that it doesn't help when we're talking about freedom and people expressing their rights and voting. It does not help to have had such a colossal, failure in some sense, although, of course, ultimately, so far, our democracy is held.
Barely.
It makes it hard to explain. But I think, again, you know, we have to just shine the light on the truth. We have to do... You know, as our government certainly needs to reveal intelligence as they have been doing, we need to get journalists over there talking to people as much as possible. You know, once Crimea, and someday Crimea will not be held under an iron vise of the Russian, you know, government. And we're going to find out a lot of horrific stories about what happened in Crimea, which was very multi-ethnic, you know, with people of Turkish ancestry or ethnicity, rather, who had been there since the time of the Ottoman Empire. And of course, the Ukrainians themselves and
Tatars. Yeah.
Yeah, the Tatars. So we will be hearing what people really thought later. You know, I think, though, that the world community, yes, it is divided. You know, we need to try to convince more of the people inside of those countries, the fence sitters, and certainly, if we can, the autocrats, that we do still stand for freedom, even though our democracy is flawed.
What about the people when it comes to Russia? Like, I'm really curious. I mean, I you know, protests are happening right now against Putin's reserve call up. And that is significant. But I think in Russia, sometimes protests take on an outsized importance in the media, and they're not as big and impactful as we think on the outside. Although, as you said, there are no journalists in there to tell us what's really happening. But does the U.S. have any way right now in terms of intelligence to monitor that and get messages through, cracking through the Russian state media and speaking directly to the Russian people? Or is that just impossible right now?
Well, I mean, it's hard for us to get through. I think we can through the internet and through Telegram. We do get through sometimes. You know, internet saturation is pretty high in Russia, but still most people watch television and believe the state propaganda. Having said that, you know, there are a lot of organizations. The McCain Institute, every year we work with EPRC, which is a Georgian think tank, Economic Policy Research Center, and we hold an annual conference. We just did it over Labor Day weekend, and one of the speakers, Natalia Arno, she runs an NGO here in America. I believe it's called the Russia Foundation. Anyway, she's a Russian-American, or maybe she's still a Russian citizen, but she was forced to flee. But yet she keeps in close touch with a dissident network all around the world, including inside Russia. She told us about Dagestani women. This is not in the U.S., you know, or Western press. Dagestani women blocking the road to Russian officials who were coming to get their men to fight in this war.
Oh, wow.
She told us, because we asked her, how much should we hold the Russian people responsible for what's being done in their name? And she said, I would hope that you don't hold them responsible, because frankly, what we don't know in the West, and I know through my networks, is how many Russians in very, very small ways are doing things like those Dagestani women. She said there's sabotage on the railroads inside Russia. We don't hear about it. So there are small acts of defiance and, you know, if you will, dissidents within the Russian Federation. It's just not covered because we don't have the press to cover it.
Yeah, but even those small acts, even if, you know, one act can't do a lot, it's really powerful to see stuff like that happening. We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank our special guest, Evelyn Farkas, Executive Director of the McCain Institute, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. Thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Anytime.
All right. I'll be back with Jill Filipovich and Ovik Roy to talk about the use of human beings in political stunts. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green, the co-founder of Fearless Media and your center. On the left, we have Jill Filipovich, lawyer and columnist at CNN.com. And on the right, Ovik Roy, president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity and policy editor at Forbes. So last week, Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis sent two planes full of migrants to Martha's Vineyard, an elite enclave off Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And the images were absolutely sickening. You had families hoping for a better life in the United States, being lied to, forced onto planes, and then landing, having no idea where they were. This was a political stunt to argue that the country's immigration challenges are a burden that should not just fall on border states. Well, this week, a civil rights law firm filed a federal class action suit against Governor DeSantis and others for transporting the immigrants from San Antonio, Texas, to Martha's Vineyard without telling them where they were going or alerting the town so they could prepare for their arrival. Jill, you have written a ton about this. And in one of your Substack columns, I just want people to know what you wrote. You said there is so much to say about the cruelty and inhumanity on display from these men and their supporters, how they relish the abject suffering they are causing, how they find it funny and entertaining. But what strikes me the most is the total lack of imagination from conservatives. They do not imagine themselves suffering. They do not imagine themselves needing help. And that fantasy drives their cruelty politics. Say more.
Sure. So what's particularly striking to me, and this is really about conservative policy writ large, but specific to immigration, when you look at where many of these migrants are coming from, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, many of them are fleeing tremendously oppressive states. Many of them don't have enough money or food to feed their families. They're seeking a better life. They're seeking political freedom. They're seeking all of the things that conservatives and liberals alike in the U.S. champion and that we also seek for our families. The fact that people's worlds fall apart, that countries become authoritarian, that wars break out, that is very, very rarely the fault of the individual citizens of those countries. So when I say that many conservatives who oppose immigration, who are treating these newcomers with such hostility, when I say that they lack imagination, that's what I mean, that they can't picture themselves being in a position where they would have to risk their lives, where they might choose to risk their lives to better their own situation. And that really does create this profound lack of empathy and this kind of inhumanity that we're seeing from red state governors, not for demanding that blue states share in helping new migrants to the U.S. Blue states should share in that process, but rather that they're treating these human beings, scared children, frightened parents, hungry people, as political pawns, as photo ops, and essentially as, you know, the butt of an extremely cruel joke.
But you're saying you can empathize somewhat with the larger point they are trying to make, even if the tactics were horrific and cruel.
Absolutely. I think it's clear that red states, many of them, obviously not all of them, but border states do take on much of the burden of migration coming from our southern border. The problem that I see is that what those states are then demanding, or what, you know, not all of them, but many of the Republican leaders of those states are demanding, is more enforcement. Well, we arrested more than 2 million migrants trying to cross the border this year. We have tough border enforcement. To me, it's that's doubling down on a strategy that isn't working. I mean, frankly, immigrants are a benefit to the United States. When you look at across generations, immigrant families give more to the country than they take. We're experiencing a massive labor shortage at the moment. And part of that is driven by the fact that immigration ground to a halt during the COVID pandemic. So this really is, in addition to being cruel and inhumane, it's also, frankly, quite self-defeating for America's economic interests.
Ovik, what do you make of the larger point that the people like DeSantis are trying to make, aside from the tactics they used, which were awful?
Yeah, you'll get no disagreement with me on the tactical point. I think on the broader issues, though, there's a lot to say. First of all, there's a broad consensus in America in favor of humanitarian assistance through asylum and true asylum and refugees. The problem is that it's not all people who are coming to the U.S. using the asylum process are actual victims of persecution and torture in other countries. That's number one, and that's a source of great frustration among many people who live in the border states and who don't. Another piece of it is that if someone is trying to leave, say, Guatemala or Venezuela because they're being persecuted in that country, the United States is not the only place they can emigrate to, right? They can emigrate to a lot of other countries where they may not be persecuted or tortured. And that was the intent of the Trump administration policy of saying, hey, if you're migrating to Mexico and then trying to migrate to the U.S. from Mexico, but you're actually from a third country, then maybe you should apply for asylum in Mexico rather than in the United States.
But aren't we proud as Americans to be a place where people want to come and start a life over?
Oh, absolutely. And so if we want to admit more immigrants, and I believe that we should, then we should do so through actual congressional statutes instead of saying, you know what, the laws on the books don't matter. We're not going to enforce them. We're going to let people abuse the laws on the books or the rules on the books to come in through the southern border. That's not the way it's supposed to work. I mean, I'm the son of immigrants who, at a time, my parents came to this country from India at a time when only 100 people from the Republic of India were allowed into the United States every year. That was a profoundly unfair and racist system. But, you know, I would still say that if we want to have a system that actually does attract the best and the brightest, the people who do improve our economy, then yes, let's have that system. That's not the system we have when it comes to our legal immigration regime, where it's mostly about family reunification, not the best and brightest from around the world coming here with their skills that can help improve our economy. And it's certainly not what's going on at the border. Matt Iglesias, talking about Substack, he had a great piece on his Substack a couple days ago called Bring Back the Old Bipartisan Immigration Consensus, where he made these points that one of the big problems right now is that Biden, by blowing up the Remain in Mexico policy when it comes to asylum seekers, has actually created this problem where we don't have the legal infrastructure to evaluate the legitimacy of the asylum claims that come through. And that's
leading
to a lot of people.
Yeah, we're saying families can come in if they want to apply for asylum. You can be here and you can go through the legal process.
Right, and but they don't have to show up. Like, they may get a court date, and do they show up at the court date? Probably not. 90% of them don't. And then when they don't, what do we do? Right, so that's a broken process, and Americans are entitled to be frustrated by that.
Well, speaking of the broken process, I mean, I nostalgically look back to 2007. I was covering the White House then, and George W. Bush and the late Senator Ted Kennedy were so close to a big immigration deal. I mean, there were hard things to swallow on both sides of the aisle, but it gave legal status to millions of people. And in theory, it would have prevented the chaos and the broken system we see in our laws today. Maybe. But that bill died. Is getting back to a moment like that ever possible? Or has that ship just totally sailed in our politics?
If you actually look at polling data, the polling data indicates that support for immigration, especially legal immigration, is actually increasing, has been increasing over the last 20 years. 20 years ago, 53% of Americans believed that legal immigration should be reduced. Today, that proportion is down to 24%. So we're seeing actually an increased consensus in favor of immigration, broadly speaking. But people are still not happy about the chaotic system in which people, if they just kind of hustle to the front of the line but don't actually apply in the proper way, get in first. That's something that people don't want. So I do think that there's an appetite for reform of immigration. I think the place to start, so much of the debate and the reason why the debate hasn't worked is it's been about what to do about illegal immigration. But what if we actually had a debate about how to improve legal immigration, how to improve the ways in which people come to this country legally? If we did that, we could do a lot to make a lot of the things that are illegal immigration today actually legal. For example, seasonal guest workers. Seasonal guest workers used to be legal prior to 1965. We made them illegal, and that led to a lot of people overstaying their visas, et cetera. So there are a lot of things that we can do to improve legal immigration. If we do that, then what is called illegal immigration becomes a much narrower problem.
Jill, on the left, I feel like getting to a place of being open to some sort of policy compromise down the road would mean, I don't want to say looking past, but not taking the bait in moments like this when DeSantis and Greg Abbott in Texas do these kinds of things, when Donald Trump makes just absolutely offensive remarks. I mean, of course you have to react, but it's like, how do people on the left say all that's going on, all that noise, it's terrible, but like maybe there's some sort of solution we can come to? Is that even possible?
I think it's absolutely possible. And I do think folks on the left are offering some pretty viable solutions. I think it's unfortunate that, for example, the Biden administration has really not followed up on its promises to rapidly scale up the number of refugees that we are admitting. Talking about illegal immigration, seeking asylum is not actually illegal. It's quite legal. And many of the problems with our immigration system, including particularly the court system, is a lack of funding. It's a lack of resources. It's the fact that asylum claims can take 3, 4, 5, 7 years to process because we just don't have the resources and the human power to do it. You know, that is a solvable problem. And I do think it's good, frankly, that folks on the left amplify the kinds of steps being taken by governors like Greg Abbott, governors like Ron DeSantis, when they amplify these really ugly anti-immigrant comments that Donald Trump makes, because those views simply don't represent how most Americans feel about immigration. Most Americans are open to new arrivals. And I think most Americans would agree that the best path forward would be to create the ability for new arrivals come here, ideally through legal channels, but unfortunately, many of those have been closed off, and then find stability and the ability to support their families and give back to the economy as quickly as possible. And I really think it's only folks on the left that seem to be offering viable solutions for that.
Can I ask you both about this piece I read in the Washington Post from The Economist, Tyler Cowen? He said left-wing intellectuals, you know, talk a lot about income equality, about egalitarianism today. And, you know, you look at Martha's Vineyard, which is largely wealthy, which has been voting Democratic for decades. And he said that the altruism and the generosity from Vineyard residents in this moment was amazing, but it only goes so far. And that a true commitment to egalitarianism would mean constructing affordable housing on Martha's Vineyard, not just for immigrants, but for lower income people to live and work on the island. I mean, is that a fair point and a fair narrative to kind of look at when it comes to what you hear from the left and what you see happening?
I actually think this is a theme that's far broader than education, right? The way in which the upper middle class and the wealthy talk about how magnanimous they are, but when it comes to things like school choice or zoning laws that would allow for more affordable housing, or any number of things that would expand social mobility but decrease the cost of living and therefore maybe increase the diversity of the neighborhoods in which they live, there's massive opposition. We see this in Marin County in California. We see this in Martha's Vineyard. We see this in wealthy suburbs all over the country. And it's a huge problem, the incredible power of the top 10% of the country, not the top 1%, but the top 10%. To raise the drawbridge behind them. And I think that's been an underappreciated problem.
Jill?
I agree with that. What I would say is that I think that resistance comes, I mean, both obviously from pure self-interest, but also from a greater sense of precarity that is infusing American life even among the top 10%. And so to me, the question is, how do you talk about these issues in a way that frames them in terms of solidarity, in terms of mutual benefit? You know, if what you're doing is lecturing folks in the top, 10% or 20%, you know, that you're a bad person, you're a bad progressive if you don't want to build affordable housing in Martha's Vineyard, I'm not sure that that gets you very far. I think instead, one thing that the left generally needs to work on is a message that emphasizes the ways in which everyone can benefit from these policies when we have more affordable housing, when we have better funded public education, when our neighborhoods and our schools are more diverse and much less racially segregated. And I think that's what we haven't quite nailed, is how to talk about these issues in a way that is persuasive and effective and not simply lecturing and shaming.
You know, I would just add that it's not just a messaging problem, it's a substance problem, right? A lot of the policies that the left advocates actually have regressive outcomes, right? So if you increase the cost of energy for low-income consumers, they have less money. If you flood the market with money such that the cost of real estate goes up, then people can't afford a place to live. So I think there needs to be a reassessment on the center-left and the left of to what degree the policies they advocate increase the cost of everyday life for lower and middle income Americans, because that's a big driver of wealth and income inequality in the United States.
Ovik, I feel like we could spend an entire segment talking about some of the policies you're referring to and whether they rob lower income families of money or not, but that's a whole other story.
Next time,
totally. Ovik Roy and Jill Filipovich, we're going to be right back to talk about the end of the pandemic or not. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We are back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, David Green, coming at you from the center. On the right, Ovik Roy, policy editor at Forbes. And on the left, we have Joe Filipovich, lawyer and columnist at CNN.com. So last week on the show, we talked about the World Health Organization Director General declaring that an end is in sight to the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, a few days later, President Biden said it wasn't just in sight. He said on 60 Minutes that the pandemic is over. And this led to outrage on both sides of the aisle, and even some surprise, it seems, from Biden's own staff. So will declaring an end to this crisis limit needed government aid and potentially suppress vaccination rates? Ovik, you specialize in healthcare policy. I know you're a physician. Tell me how you see this. Is it too early to declare this pandemic over? And what are the risks in doing that?
It's a complicated thing to call a pandemic over. It's like the flu pandemic is never over, right? It always comes back in a different form.
So simmers.
It simmers. And so I think binary terms like over are more political or messaging oriented than they are real. Having said that, I think on the flip side, it's been somewhat comical, the kind of the public health authorities, they say, well, we've got to continue to scare people and terrify people about COVID, otherwise they won't get their fourth booster shot. That seems like not commonsensical either. I think it's prudent to acknowledge reality. The reality is that at this point in the pandemic, the vast, vast majority of people have acquired immunity either through vaccination or through recovery from infection or both. There obviously are still people who are vulnerable and we need to work to protect them. But that is the status of things. We are gradually returning to normal and that's good. And Biden should acknowledge that and celebrate that. And to the point you're alluding to in your question, that does mean that the declaration of a public health emergency, it's long overdue to end that declaration, and the hesitation in doing so has largely been because if you formally declare an end to the public health emergency, all sorts of spigots of government activity turn off, and that's a really important thing to start to resolve.
But not just the official declaration. I mean, even saying something like this. I mean, I'm just imagining, you know, that comment being out there in the news. And couldn't people in their own communities, like, use that to mock neighbors who still feel safer wearing masks and sending their kids to school in masks? I mean, there could be some real kind of cultural realities here.
Well, I don't know about you, but I haven't encountered that in real life. I think what I've seen is people who wear masks are you know, allowed to go about their business, and people who don't are allowed to go about their business, and that has I don't think that many people begrudge the way others have handled their own personal sense of risk or concern about safety. And that's, I think Americans in general have an instinct of live and let live. Not all, of course.
Not all.
But most. And at least what I see in the communities that I spend time in has been really healthy in that regard.
Jill, I mean, Anthony Fauci commented on Biden's remark and said it's all just semantics. But I just feel like a president's words matter when the stakes are high.
They do matter. And I think, unfortunately, even though Biden was quite clear that he was saying the acute emergency phase of the pandemic is over, but COVID is not over. What a lot of people heard is COVID is over.
Yeah.
Stop worrying about it. At the same time as we have a new variant emerging. And it's frankly, the rollout of the latest booster shot has been pretty weak. We already know that most Americans didn't get their booster, their last booster. I don't think that this administration is investing as much energy and effort as they should be in pushing the latest booster shots. I think we've seen bigger campaigns for flu shots, and that's good. But unfortunately, it does seem like COVID is going in that direction. And saying the pandemic is over, I do think gives people the impression that they just never have to worry about COVID ever again. And that's frankly not true.
I was kind of shocked by the walk back after Biden made these remarks. I mean, the administration is now making the argument that Biden was just, you know, capturing what Americans are feeling. And I mean, I may feel like dropping missiles on Russian military bases to end the war in Ukraine, given that what's happening there right now. Does that mean Biden should go out like a warmonger just because I feel that way? Like that just didn't make sense to me and didn't kind of solve the problem.
It sounds like Biden was speaking off the cuff, and that was not the most tightly controlled remark of his presidency. But look, I think that in many ways, actually, the left and Democrats have a much trickier time politically navigating COVID than Republicans and folks on the right do. I think that the right is kind of much more united on this issue and much more united in frankly, a lot of the denialism. Whereas I think folks on the left in the U.S. and into the center really do run the gamut of how cautious they think we should be, how much they think the government should be investing in continuing to fight COVID, and what our individual obligations are. And a lot of those beliefs around COVID don't actually seem to track on the kind of center to left spectrum. And so I do think Democrats and Joe Biden are in a very tough spot with wanting to get the economy back on track, wanting to make Americans feel like they can get back to normal, but also not wanting to exacerbate an ongoing public health problem, and also not wanting to alienate the part of their base that does want COVID to be continued to be considered an emergency.
Ovik?
Yeah, I mean, we are no longer in a COVID crisis, right? I mean, there is widespread immunity. It took us a long time to get there, but we did get there. Yes, there are variants. Yes, the immunity can fade, and you do need boosters to help with maintaining one's immunity. Again, just like with influenza, but you know, if you look at influenza, about 50%, actually under 50% of people get the flu shot every fall, every winter, and yet because there's widespread immunity to influenza, we do okay. So this idea that we have to be on this kind of war footing for the rest of our lives, so long as there's a variant out there, it's not a good strategy from a public health standpoint, right? People do need to go back to normal. They need to educate their kids. They need to be able to see their friends. They need to attend their parents' funerals. And so I think, you know, there is actually a spectrum of views on the right too. There's I think the center right view is more, let's obviously be mindful of public safety, but reopen the economy and society and schools where scientifically prudent, which it clearly is today. And then there are denialists on the right who, you know, anti-vaxxers, et cetera. There's anti-vaxxers on the left too, like Robert Kennedy Jr. There's a range, there's a diversity of opinions there. But I think where conservatives are united across the spectrum is this view that the economy is open now and it should be open, and people should be enabled to live their lives as much as possible.
Well, I mean, and that speaks to why I kind of felt like the president saying something like this is so important, because we are all wondering, we're all wanting guidance, we're all wanting leadership. We all have these questions. Like, you know, I have been on a lot of planes recently. I don't wear a mask on a plane. I see some of my fellow passengers wearing masks. And there was a time 5-6 months ago where I was like, am I being a jerk for not wearing a mask because they, you know, want to feel safe? And is it okay that I'm not? You know, we go to restaurants and, you know, I kind of take note of who's doing what. And we know a lot of people, when they hear from friends like, oh, they haven't gotten their booster, like there's some judgment in that, or people obsessing about getting their boosters and someone doesn't believe in boosters, there's judgment in that. You're seeming to say like we've reached the point where we can kind of let go of that kind of stuff because we are okay.
People who are at risk obviously need to take more prudential measures to protect themselves, and that's totally understandable. And I think most people are willing to respect that. At the same time, the idea that we should continue to just cower in fear about a virus that most of us have meaningful immunity to now at this point is frankly irrational and anti-scientific. So if we're going to be about following the science, then we have to recognize that immunity works, that vaccines work. And I just attended a conference where every single person at this conference was vaccinated. We'd all had multiple vaccinations, and yet we were required to test every day. And I get that, like, you know, again, there may be vulnerable people that you need to protect, but the message that sends the average person is, well, if you're still on a war footing and you're still freaking out about everything, then what you're telling me is vaccines don't work. Because if vaccines work, then I should be able to live a normal life if I've been vaccinated, if I've done the things that that the authorities have recommended. So I think that's where the strategy really undermines itself, is if we are vaccinated or we have recovered successfully from a COVID infection, we have immunity, and you're telling me I still have to act as if none of that has happened, then what the message underneath that is that vaccines don't work.
Jill, I mean, there's still workplaces that require masks. I'm sitting in one right now in a studio where we're all wearing masks when we're near each other. I mean, when President Biden says something like that, I mean, what do you do if you're in a workplace where you are wearing a mask and you feel safer doing it, or you're supporting your company? Like it just, I don't know. And maybe this speaks to what you were saying. Like the left just doesn't really know what to do in terms of messaging now. And we saw that on display with what the White House was dealing with this week with Biden's comments.
Well, I think one of the most unfortunate aspects of this period of whatever we want to call it, post-pandemic COVID wind down.
You just declared the pandemic over. This right? is very troubling.
Exactly. But I think something that's been really, for me, quite disappointing is this binary choice between COVID forever or back to normal. And, you know, there can be third and fourth and fifth ways forward. I mean, I would love to see us look at what wasn't working particularly well in the before times, right? What did work well during COVID, and thinking about, okay, what can we pick and choose as we move forward? And whether that's more flexible work from home policies, whether that's a greater investment in childcare, which clearly did not work particularly well during the pandemic and created its own kind of sub-emergency, whether that's creating certain spaces, for example, on public transport or other public spaces, you know, in the theater, at shows where people can all be masked in the same section if they choose, which would certainly open up many more opportunities for public presence of people who are immunocompromised or who simply don't want to get sick during that period. There are all kinds of creative solutions beyond let's go back to normal, COVID is over, or let's stay masked in the office for the rest of our lives.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. I like the message of not everything has to be binary. Okay, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jill Filipovich, I will start with you. What's on your mind?
So my rant today is also a bit of a rave. It is a rave for the women in Iran who have taken to the streets protesting against the morality police after a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini died while in their custody. Iran has incredibly misogynist laws. It mandates female modesty in public. And these women are risking their lives. Several have reportedly been killed. Many, many have been injured to take to the streets and say, enough, we are human beings, down with the dictator and down with this authoritarian misogynist regime. And my rant, or I guess request, for American feminists, Western feminists, liberals the world over, is to stand with Iranian women in their immediate struggle and against the kind of encroachments on women in public space, on women wearing what we choose and doing what we choose with our bodies, wherever it is we live.
All right. Yeah, what's happening in Iran is so powerful. I think we need to bring that onto the show very soon to talk about it a lot more. Ovik Roy, it's your soapbox.
I love that one. I'm going to rant about middle-aged sports fans who always complain that the game was purer and more wonderful back when they were kids. And that may be true to a degree, but I want to highlight one sport that actually is going to be a lot better in the near future than it has been in the recent past, and that's college football. The combination of the expansion of the college football Division I playoff to 12 teams means that every even minor conference team is going to have a shot, a Cinderella shot at a national championship. You combine that with the recent Supreme Court case, NCAA v. Alston, which basically opens the door to players now finally getting to share in the incredible billions of dollars of revenue that are flowing through the sport for the first time. And I think in the near future, college football is going to have more fans. It's going to be fairer to the players who generate all the value, and it's going to be more exciting than it's ever been.
Okay. All right, for my rant, I want to congratulate Ted Cruz for all of his hard work getting a highway expansion in his home state of Texas approved by Congress. Senator Cruz wants everyone to know how he's helping to bring jobs and money to Texas. Cruz has done press conferences. He has sent out self-congratulatory press releases. Heck, the only thing he hasn't done is remind people that he actually voted against this project. Well, his office said if the project had gotten an up or down vote on its own, Cruz would have voted yes, but when it got stuck into a larger spending package, Cruz just had to vote against it. The senator's office has tweaked its language about the project, saying now that Senator Cruz, quote, made it possible. Real winner of a campaign message there. Vote Ted Cruz. He votes against the things that he makes possible. All right, that is all the time we have for today. I want to thank Ovik Roy, Jill Filipovich, and Evelyn Farkas. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Alexander Applegate. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. I'm David Green. We appreciate you joining us, and tune in next week for a whole lot more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.